Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to XYZ, the podcast about CNC, automation, robotics, business, and more. My name is Nick Frank, one of the owners of Frank Brothers Guitar Company, and I'm joined by my co-host, Aaron Goff of Goff Custom Knives. What's happening?
Oh, it's been a shit day. That's what's happening.
I'm
having a beer now. I'm chatting to you, so things are looking
usually,
up.
But... you're usually not drinking when we podcast.
I am today. It's just been one of those days. Like, nothing horrible has been going on, but it's just been like, you ever have a day where you just think about burning the place down for the insurance money?
I'm not going to answer that question on recording.
Well, today was one of those days.
There's definitely those days where you're like, I wonder if I could move to a different country and start my life all over again.
How do you feel about the business overall? Do you feel like you're a happy... satisfied person, or would you?
This is a deep question.
Yeah, we're starting out.
I don't know.
Because I'm sure it's stressful, right? Like, do you find running a business stressful?
I do. I think we're never where we want to be, and if we were, where we wanted to be, we probably still wouldn't be satisfied.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Yeah, like, if I looked back 5 years ago or 3 years ago, I'd be like, holy shit, that's sick. So I don't know. It's just a growing, desire to do better.
I think that's one of the hallmarks of, and not to give myself too many props here, but I think that's like one of the hallmarks of people that really push and really work and get quality stuff done is that you're never quite happy. You're always looking for the next thing to improve on, So that drives you to improve a lot, but it also means that it can be really hard to like look back and be like, oh yeah, we're doing good,
I know. Okay. We talk about this sometimes, in entrepreneurship or just in, manufacturing, whatever, like in running a business, the highs are like moderately high, kind of medium high, and the lows are like devastatingly low.
Yeah. 100%.
And I also with manufacturing, you're always pushing to like improve.
Yes.
So maybe that's part and parcel with running the business too.
Yeah. Yep.
I don't know. Things just change too. Like, you take on more overhead and then your goals change. Mm-hmm. So it's like what would have been good 3 years ago is now not good enough.
Yeah. Yeah.
So you need to push past that.
100%.
What can you talk a little bit about what's bringing you down?
It's just been like, so this month has been really slow in terms of new orders, which is not great. But then I had a bunch of things that kind of put me off my focus, off my process. So I was slow, and so I still haven't caught up with the orders from last month. Yeah. So it's been very frustrating. I feel like I've been working really hard, but treading water because I'm doing a lot of stuff kind of not in the ideal ways, And then today, so the job that I hate most in the shop is sandblasting.
Okay.
I hate it.
Yeah, I know.
And which means I put it off. And then I end up having to do it all in one big go. So today I wore my respirator for like 6 hours. I was just sandblasting all day. I'm still not done. And I don't want to spend money on my sandblasting cabinet because I know I'm replacing it. So the sandblasting cabinet is a heap of shit. It's like literally, I literally spent 2 hours today finding all the problems with it and fixing them with tape.
Oh God.
You know what I mean? Like so the sandblasting cabinet has a siphon tube and basically it wasn't pulling sand up. So I was like, oh God, like I know that there's a hole in the actual blasting gun itself. There's a hole where the sand is like worn through the side of the sandblasting gun.
Wow.
But that I had also worn through my rudimentary patch from last time, so I had to patch it again.
It's just like, it's just blasted a hole right through the side of it. Like,
yeah.
The hole that wasn't there before.
Yeah. Yeah, straight through the aluminum body of the sandblasting gun. Like, I use tungsten carbide nozzles in my sandblasting gun, and I still have to replace them every, like, 6 months.
That's wild.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, and, you know, as I said, like, I'm planning to replace it with the automated sandblasting cabinet, but that has kind of fallen off because, I don't know if I told you about this, but I found this really awesome 3D printing material, which is carbon fiber reinforced polycarbonate co-polyester blend. It's really nice stuff, but it's not super cheap, and I used a bunch of it to print parts for the sandblasting robot, and I had checked the dimensions and tolerances on the 3D printer before I started printing it, but I didn't check them after I started printing parts, and it turns out they're all fucked.
No.
So I've got like $150 worth of, like, you know, really nice carbon fiber filament in scrap. You know, like, I have to laugh at it because it's just stupid. And then today was like, you know, so sandblasting, I scrapped a blade, which I hardly ever do. That's like a 1 in 100 thing.
Oh, really?
I smashed my finger with a hammer, so I've got like a nice black finger now. You know, it's just, I'm gonna have a gripe. It's one of those fucking days, you know?
Yeah, yeah. No, I can appreciate that. I've been having this,
yeah, like constantly regularly for
years.
Yeah, yeah.
yeah. No, I mean, you kind of you have to just
push through it, right?
Well, I wasn't even going to say that. You just have to have those, unfortunately.
Yeah, no, it's true.
Part of business.
Yeah, yeah. One of the things that's making it a bit more painful at the moment is you know, last year was obviously a really slow year for most people, right? Mm-hmm. It was pretty slow for me. It was slow for me in terms of business, but really busy for me. I was just feeling really down for most of the year, which meant that I wasn't working at peak efficiency. So the work would just spread out, you know, so I felt like I was working all the time and just kind of getting shit done.
With less results.
Yeah, it was a really crap year. But then I also moved at the start of the year, so...
which is a lot of work.
Yeah, and I incurred a bunch of debt doing that, right? Because you're moving, you're not, like...
Producing.
You're not producing, and moving is, like, you know, it's... You guys haven't done it yet since you moved into your shop, but... Well, I guess you kind of moved when you had your flood, didn't you?
We did. We experienced what the aggravation and expense of it, even though we didn't pay for it. Like,
right.
We didn't pick up the tab. We did pay for it, and because we didn't have... What do they call it? We weren't insured to, like, cover the loss of revenue that we didn't generate while we were out.
Right, right.
But yeah, so it is expensive and it's aggravating.
Mm-hmm.
And it, yeah, you were obviously not producing at the time.
Yeah. So, like, I didn't go into that period with enough of a cushion to fully cover the expense of, like, moving and the loss of production. So I incurred some debt during that time. And I've just been sitting on that. Like, last year, I didn't really have the ability to pay that back. And then this year, I've been really aggressive about paying it back. But that means that I'm paying my personal rent and paying for groceries. And that's like, that's it. So this year, you know, when you have a moment like this, where it's just like, everything's hard. And then you're like, I'm not even getting fucking paid. Why am I even doing this? You know, like, why? It would be so much easier to work for someone else.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, you ever just think about, like, you're like, man, maybe I'll go back to school, become a doctor or something. How long does that take? 8 years?
Well, the problem for me, so this is a blessing and a curse, right? So, like, my day job before knife making is software development, like software engineering. And I could, like, walk back into that.
Mm-hmm.
It definitely pays better than knife making does.
Yeah.
So there's always that, like, temptation to just be like, fuck it.
Which you have done before.
Yeah, and in that case, it wasn't really like, fuck it. That was, I described that as like stepping off the sinking ship just in time, you know, because like at that point in time, so what's Nick's referring to is, 2017, I went from being full-time to part-time, and I went back to doing software development because shit just wasn't working in the shop. Like, I had customers, but, like, you know, at that point in time, I remember a batch of 30 knives took me 6 months. You know, so
it's too long.
Yeah, way too long. So your fixed expenses, like rent and insurance, and it just kills you, you know. So you, like, I was literally going backwards. And I went back to working full time with a pretty large amount of debt. Like, it was like well beyond some credit card debt, you know. And yeah, and I still had to work in the knife making business as well.
Right. So like two full time jobs.
Yeah. It was like easily 60 hours a week, you know. Yeah, I don't know. Like, I've considered whether I should go back to doing some like software contracting. You know, that
yeah,
way
I mean, that's not a bad idea.
Yeah, do it one day a week or something. Keep my
We could probably use your help.
Dude, I would love to help you guys. We should maybe we should talk about that. I can come and do some like process software for you.
Yeah, I mean, I've got ideas about the stuff that we need.
I can deliver on those ideas.
Yeah, no, it's a trip. Well, the fixed expense thing is just always aggravating because, like, it, you know, business fluctuates. Orders, like, you'll have a really great month and then, you know, inevitably a really slow month. But your fixed expenses always the same.
Yeah, yeah, 100%. Well, and it was – so, like, my old shop, when I moved into my old shop, I was paying, like, $800 a month for about 500 square feet, which is – you know, I look at it now, I'm like, oh, Jesus, that's nothing. By the time,
$100, that's great.
Yeah, by the time I left, I was paying $1,500. And I was only there for like 4 years. 1 year, my landlord jacked my rent by 30%.
Yeah, commercial is brutal like that. Yeah. Like, you can't do that in residential.
No.
But commercial, they just, I mean, you can sign, we have a lease, and in the lease, the rent goes up every year, but after that lease is up, they could triple it.
Yeah, exactly.
And you see that happening. Toronto, I mean, I don't know, I'm pretty close to it because, you know, I live here, same with you.
Yeah,
but you see that happening, and it's, I think it's famous. Toronto's kind of like known for this, or has become known for this, where like a restaurant will move in, be there for 5 years, and then boom, they're gone, and you're like, where did that restaurant go? And then you hear, oh, the landlord quadrupled the rent, and now A&W is there.
Yeah.
Like a Burger King.
Yeah, it's brutal. It is pretty brutal, and like, unfortunately, that's driven a lot of like artists and manufacturing and all that kind of stuff out of the city, you know. Like,
yeah, they used to come to the East End where we are, or go, you know, to the West End. West End became more hip,
yeah,
faster, and then they got driven to the East End, I feel like.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, now a lot of people move into like Hamilton, which for people not familiar with, Southern Ontario, is basically around the lake, south, through a dog leg around the lake.
Yeah.
And it's now Hamilton's becoming expensive.
Yeah. Really expensive. Yeah. I don't know. I think the long term, you know, my girlfriend and I have this plan that we'll hopefully execute on at some point, you know, like the main issue is just financial, really. It, like, we want to get out of the city. We want to have our own property. I would love to either buy a place with a shop or build a shop. But yeah, even that, like we were looking at a place the other day. It was like, I think it was listed for 550 grand, which is like still quite a lot of money, you know, like down in the States, it boggles my mind sometimes. Like how cheap stuff can be, but you know, up here, so that's an hour and a half away from Toronto. It was listed for 550 grand and it sold for 750.
Yeah.
And it had a four car garage and a truck workshop on the
that's
property.
Fantastic.
Yeah. So it would have been perfect for a machine shop like mine, but you know, the house was tiny. The house was only like 800 square feet, 1,000 square feet.
Oh, wow. That's small.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, Southern Ontario, really expensive. Move to New Brunswick or, I don't know, Saskatchewan.
Yeah, seriously. Maybe.
Yeah.
Do you guys ever want to get outside the city? Maybe we should start a little manufacturing commune out in the country.
Yeah, that's great. I mean, we've thought about moving further east, like Scarborough,
right,
which is a suburb of Toronto.
I've done it, and I didn't enjoy the extra commute.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's more of a, it would be more of a car commute.
Mm-hmm.
So, well, that's, yeah, interesting to talk about. little, I mean, I love to gripe much as the next guy.
Oh, yeah, sometimes you just got to get it out, you know? Like,
for sure. That's part of why we meet up at the pub.
Yeah,
pre-pandemic.
Yeah, you were the one that taught me that phrase, like having a gripe. What, yeah. You said that you got that from the military, right?
Oh yeah, I think it's something to do with the army. I don't know. Somebody listening probably knows better than I do.
Well, the army is the
soldier's gripe. Allowed to, I think. That's part of the duty.
Well, that's where the term snafu got invented, right? Situation normal, all fucked up.
Right, yeah. Or FUBAR.
Yeah, which, if anyone's not aware, FUBAR stands for Fucked Up Beyond All Recognition, which is good.
Yeah, well.
What about you, man?
Anything
good? Is that what you're going to say?
Anything good.
You know what, man? There's been some good stuff. Yeah, I finally got glow-in-the-dark liners working for my
nose. I saw that. They looked incredible.
They look, yeah. Thank you, man. They look, I'm really, really happy with them. And so it was really funny. I think I said last week that I was making that pressure casting chamber.
Yeah.
And so I had someone reach out to me on Instagram, say like, look, man, I'm really worried about what you're doing. Like, it looks really risky to me. I work in petrochemical engineering and deal with this stuff all the time, you know? And so I posted a retraction because I was like, you know, I was like, or a warning at least. I was like,
right,
don't do what I did. Like, you know, I considered it to be acceptably risky. I hid behind my lathe when I was pressuring up that system for the first time. But I should have done some different stuff. I should have done hydro test, which is where you use an incompressible fluid to pressure test it.
Oh, to see if it leaks out?
Or to see if the vessel itself is going to fracture. Because like the pipe is, and the fittings are rated for a certain pressure, but there's no guarantee. Apparently they don't test them at the factory. So there's no guarantee that those things aren't faulty. You know,
oh, okay, right.
Have like a bad weld or something. You know? And so I posted the you know, danger, don't do this. And then I started getting responses. So I've had responses from multiple pipe fitters, like master pipe fitters, welders, machinists, engineers. And the responses have been everything from like, he's right, you're practically already dead, to like, why is this even a conversation? Like, what you're doing is as safe as, like, you know, sitting on the ground. It's been really, really interesting, actually, the breadth of opinions about this.
Well, it's funny because, like, I mean, 150 PSI or what is it, 125?
120, yeah.
100, it doesn't sound like a lot.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's any air compressor. Like, you could blast yourself with 120 PSI right. from a gun.
Yeah.
Air gun.
I mean, the biggest issue is that, like, it's the pressure.
I don't recommend doing that, by the way. You shouldn't blast. You shouldn't point an air gun at yourself.
I do it all the time, but yeah, don't do
it. Everyone does it, Aaron.
Yeah, but you're not supposed to. Yeah. You know what? The biggest reason you shouldn't do that is if you have black iron pipes or galvanized steel pipes and you have debris from the inside of the pipe,
yes,
which will then be accelerated into your body at extremely
deposited high into your.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've heard of oil, people tattooing themselves.
Yeah, yeah.
sorry, but yeah.
Yeah, I mean, the biggest issue is just that, like, when you have a vessel like that, you have a ton of pressure in there, right? So it's 120 PSI, so it's 120 pounds per square inch. So if that pipe is, you know, 20 square inches, then that's like, you know, 3,000 pounds worth of pressure stored up in there on those walls of that vessel. Don't check my math on that. I'm really bad at off the top of your head math. And if there was, you know, a hairline fracture in one of the walls or something and it failed, then that air is like a spring. It would accelerate the fragments out, you know, once the vessel failed, and then you basically have a bomb. Mm-hmm. So it could go bad, absolutely. But I worked out the hoop stress calculations for that vessel. So that's, you have the pressure going outward, you know, trying to radiate out in every direction. And to resist it, you're basically thinking about the stress in a circle, like not pointing outward, but going along the line of the circle, you know, because you've got like a steel circle, that's your pipe, right, mm-hmm. that's holding it. And so that calculation is called hoop stress calculation. And it worked out for this vessel to about 1,000 PSI in the walls of the vessel. So there's, you know, 1,000 pounds per square inch of tension on those walls. Uh-huh. And cold rolled steel's rated for 48,000 PSI. So if it was made of cold rolled steel, it's made of wrought, the pipe is made of wrought steel with a welded seam. Okay. So that means, you know, if the strength of that steel is equivalent to cold rolled, like 1018 cold rolled, then you have a 48 times safety margin. Now, that's not including like potential material defects, the welding, the mm-hmm. iron fittings, et cetera. Yeah. But, you know, so anyway, like it was very interesting that I got so many different answers, right?
Yeah.
You know, so what I'm going to do, I'm going to approach this in my typical fashion. I bought a grease gun, which you can use as a really shitty hydraulic pump. I bought all the gear to do a 6,000 PSI hydro test, and I'm going to test a couple of vessels to failure and see what the actual like safety margin is.
So with a grease gun, you're going to pipe in water. Grease. Oh, water.
Yeah. Yeah. So fill the vessel with water, get rid of all the bubbles, fill the grease gun with water, pipe them together and pump away until it pops.
Oh, crazy. And you can reach that kind of pressure with a grease gun?
Yeah.
Yeah. Huh.
So the grease gun itself is rated for 6,000 PSI. The hoses that I bought are rated for 3,500 PSI. And the theoretical burst pressure of the pipe that I'm using is about 2,200 PSI.
Okay. So you should be able to max it out. Should is a grease gun rated to that? Like, okay, because a grease gun has to push grease through the ball bearing of a nipple on a...
Yeah.
And a grease fitting or whatever, a bearing. If you ever try to push that thing in by hand, it is quite hard to do.
Yeah.
So is that why it's rated so high? It's just to be able to press that
I think
ball
it's
bearing?
Really just because you're pushing a really viscous liquid through really tiny channels. You know, so like on my Fidal, I have to grease it. And some of those pipes are like 3 feet long. And the inner diameter of those pipes is like a 16th of an inch. Or smaller. So, you know, as you go down in size, the walls exert more friction on a fluid that's flowing. And then when you have a thicker fluid, it again has more friction. So I would imagine the reason for the huge pressure capacity is just to like push that really viscous fluid.
Cool.
Yeah.
Such a simple device too.
Yeah. It was like $20, you know, like,
yeah,
I could buy like a hydrostatic test pump, but you know, for the amount that I'm going to use it.
Clever.
Yeah.
Okay, stupid question.
Bring it.
Could you just take that whole pressure chamber and put it inside a bigger pipe as like a safety, you know? Like if it were to explode, it explodes inside a another.
Doing it inside a pipe would be really uneconomical because like then you're buying like an even larger and more expensive pipe, you know, so like that length of pipe that I bought for that pressure vessel was like $90 US.
Okay.
You know,
but you're talking about, you know, keeping yourself from, you know, trying to save yourself
if grievous bodily harm.
Yeah,
I get it. I think what I would do instead is use like perforated steel sheet to weld up an enclosure.
Okay.
Right, so it'd be like
you could buy more. You could have a bunch of lathes. Just like and stack the lathes around it.
There you go.
And hide behind those.
Build a bunker. Yeah. Perfect. Yeah.
So you buy sheet metal.
Yeah. And weld up a cage around it.
Right.
You know, and the reason I would use perforated metal is because you don't want to just build another sealed container around your potentially failing pressure vessel, because then you're just going to have a secondary pressure vessel to fail, right? You want it to like allow the gas to escape, but to catch all the fragments.
Yeah, I mean, I wasn't necessarily saying enclose it, like put like a fitting on either end. Just, picturing essentially a chamber to put it in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I mean, I could do that, but
it's more space and
honestly,
could be probably unnecessary. Hopefully unnecessary.
It's kind of interesting, man, because like I'm, you know, you guys used to call me Mr. Safety back in the old shop, right?
Yeah, I forgot about that.
I'm really, really safety conscious. But I think that being there's being safety conscious and then there's being like unreasonably scared. You know, like
right.
If you design a thing with the correct safety margins and you test it properly and you put it into service, like it should be fine and you shouldn't have to worry about it. You know, I think that being unreasonably scared prevents people from doing stuff that might otherwise have been awesome and worked fine and been safe. You know, mm-hmm. like you have to take care of the risks, but you can't be.
Yeah. And because you're safety conscious, you're typically when you're designing these things, you think to overbuild them.
Yes. Yeah. You know, like I put a safety relief valve on mine that pops at 125 PSI and someone else on Instagram was like, oh, that's great. I should have done that on mine. Like, oh, come on, dude.
Yeah.
So like, as I said, what I'm going to do is build a couple of little, smaller pressure vessels, like a 1-inch MPT, 2-inch MPT, and then maybe a small 3-inch MPT. Mm-hmm. I'm a little hesitant on 3-inch MPT because, as I said, that like I'm just going to be like literally destroying like $250 worth of pipe fittings.
Right.
You know, like it gets pretty pricey in the larger pipe sizes. And the smaller pipe sizes, the wall thickness and stuff is actually scaled down. You know, they don't want to use more material than they have to. So they're doing the hoop stress calculations and they're giving you exactly the right amount of wall to give you the same safety margin as you go
so
with the pipe size.
So it's to scale.
Yes.
The wall thickness isn't any, it's not
constant. As you said, it's to scale. Right. It scales with the size of the pipe. Neat. So yeah, I'll probably just do like a couple of like scale tests, you know, and then do the math on all of them and work it out. And again, that'll be like, I'll do a video of all of that, right? Because breaking shit is fun. Everyone likes to watch breaking stuff getting broken.
That's why people watch NASCAR. Is this something common in knife making?
No.
Pressure vessels?
No, not at all.
Who the hell else is making one?
Making one? So
like the guy who didn't put a safety release.
Yeah, there you go. So
what's he doing with his?
There are other people that are doing pressure casting, right? So they're making composites or they're doing like sculpture and they're doing pressure casting of epoxies. Mm. But most of those people are using paint pots. So like HVLP paint pots where you actually pressurize the paint and then you spray the paint without any air. I guess that's not HVLP. I don't know what that's called. Like direct, whatever. But if you want to buy an ASME coated paint pot, they start at like $1,700 US.
Oh.
Yeah, like they are not cheap. So when you go to like Princess Auto or Harbor Freight and you just buy a paint pot, that shit's not like coated. It's not like ASME coated, right? So like I've heard stories of people being like, you know, I said this last week. They're like, oh yeah, I run it at 60 PSI. It's rated for 60 PSI and the bottom bulges out, but it seems fine other than that.
You yeah. know?
And that's what I was trying to avoid. You know, like I'm much happier trusting my safety to myself than I am to some faceless Chinese company that's just like selling shit into North America. You know, like I'm going to look at the like burst pressure. I'm going to look at the safety margin, you know, whereas like a pressure vessel that bulges at its rated pressure is like not a good idea.
That's pretty bad.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the results again were fantastic.
Yeah, really it worked glowed. Really well. And, you know, like the other option was to do vacuum and to vacuum degas the resin. But that's a really fussy process. With this, it's just like I mix it, I pour it, I chuck it in the pressure casting chamber, and then I just leave it for like 48 hours and it's done.
That's wicked. What effect does it have on other materials like, say, wood?
Not a whole lot, I think, because wood is like kind of porous and fairly strong. So I think the extra air pressure would just get forced into the air spaces in the wood.
I wonder, because like we would need a big one, but like to cast, we did like epoxy binding. So a purfling of metallic orange epoxy. And it, we did have some bubbles.
Yeah, yeah.
So, like, could I put the whole guitar in?
Are you machining into the binding at all? Or would you be just, like, pouring it and then, like, you're done?
Pour it, and then we would machine the surface
of it. Which risks exposing bubbles.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you could totally do it. I don't know if the cost would be worth it. Like, building a pressure vessel big enough to fit a guitar inside.
But I wonder if you'd need as much pressure.
Apparently, you can get away with, like, 30 PSI.
Mm-hmm. I'd be interested in like, seeing how low you could go.
Mm-hmm. Who knows? Yeah, and I mean, I'm sure you could weld something up. And if you do, like, a hydro test, then... You know, like, that's one of those things, like, I'll make it for myself. I'm not going to make it for you guys. But you could get somebody else to do it that'll sign off on
because
it.
Because you know how litigious I am.
And yeah, if anything you're goes so wrong, litigious.
I'll sue the shit out of you.
Exactly. I don't want to risk that. Well, just more like I don't want to be responsible for blowing you guys up. You know? Mm-hmm. I'll let someone else be responsible for that. What else has been going on? It's funny, so I was talking to you about custom tooling and Maritool in the last show. And then I was talking about the brushes.
Which I actually wanted to ask you about because now I feel like I have a need for one.
Oh, nice. So I said in the last episode, maybe I should reach out to Frank about these abrasive brushes. So I did, like, that night. Mm-hmm. And then the next day he was like, okay, I have some. They'll be here in like a week.
What?
So he already had a supplier that he knew of for abrasive brushes. He placed the order for me for some samples, and they're ready to go. He's got them already.
How did he know what sizes he would want?
He just ordered a couple.
Oh.
So I think he's got, like, I believe they're diamond impregnated nylon brushes.
Okay.
He got like a 2-inch size and a 1/2-inch size and a 1/4 or something. So yeah, I'll be trying those out soon. I'll let you know how they go.
So you're brushing the surface of something.
Yeah. Right? So basically what I'm doing with the kitchen knife is I have a CAD model that doesn't have any of the sharp edges. It just has the bevel of the kitchen knife. And it's actually oversized in every direction by about 1/8 of an inch. Mm-hmm. So I go ahead and I machine that, and that leaves me with a cavity that's basically like the flat contour of the blade, like no sharp edges that I could round over or anything. Mm-hmm. And then the plan is to take an abrasive brush and brush that surface until it's good, you know, until all the tooling marks are gone and everything. And then I can come in and add the extra details like the pinholes and all that kind of stuff after that's done.
And then cut it out.
And then cut it out. Exactly.
Yes, that's really smart. I like that. It'll be one of those things where you look at it and you go, how did they do that? Like,
yeah, I mean, if I can get it to work, we'll see. So I did get a quote on the ceramic fiber brushes. So the ceramic fiber brushes are really interesting. They're taking like ceramic and kind of stretching it out like fiberglass. So rather than having like individual grains of ceramic, you actually end up with like ceramic fibers.
That's crazy to me because I think of ceramic and I think of it being very hard.
It is, but normally it would be very brittle. And
brittle.
Yeah, but the interesting thing, like fiberglass, you know, glass is very hard and brittle too, but then you turn it into a fiber and all of a sudden it's very flexible and strong.
Yeah.
And hard, you know? So they're doing that same thing and then they're bonding the individual fibers together into like a bristle. And then they're putting, you know, thousands of those bristles in a brush. Right. And those things are supposed to be like really fast cutting, really aggressive, last quite a long time. But they are real pricey. Like $250 just for one brush.
Right.
And that's for a 1/2-inch brush.
Yeah. Wow.
Right. Okay. And then you've got like $150. So this is from a company called ZBeck through their Canadian distributor. So, yeah, it was $250 for the brush, $150 for the sleeve that the brush has to be mounted in to control its length and to stop it from splaying out too much. Because the bristles are like...
You control the bristle length.
Yeah, the bristle length is about like 1.5 inches. And then you put it in the sleeve and that keeps the bristles from like, you know, spreading out when you spin it up.
And as it wears, you can pull that sleeve back.
Exactly. Yeah. But so, you know, we're already at like $400 just to try one brush. You know,
better to let Frank get some samples in of something else.
Man, honestly, like if the samples from Frank are like reasonably priced and they work, I would love to just be able to give Frank more money. You know, like,
oh, it makes your life so much easier too. You're already 100%. Ordering tools from him.
Yeah.
Okay. So what I want is, okay, we're making a pickup surround. So the pickup surround is what mounts the electronic. Or the guitar pickup, which is what makes the guitar electric. It's an electromagnet, essentially. It mounts it to the body. So it's just a black plastic ring, typically.
Right.
And we machine them. And it's 3D contoured on the bottom. It's flat on the top. And then it's just it's basically like a hexagon, an elongated hexagon in its shape.
Okay.
And that's cut. We cut that to shape. And the top of it is the original surface finish from the black plastic, which is a cast acrylic. So it's shiny.
Right.
And we want it to be shiny.
Right.
Then we obviously, the underside is contoured to the arch of the top of the guitar.
Mm-hmm.
That's a machined surface. We don't really care we want the surface finish to be nice, but you're never going to see it.
Right. You want it to be nice, so if someone takes it apart, they're like, ooh, that's nice.
So it sits evenly and like is seamless along the edge.
Yep,
totally. And then the edge of the pickup surround, highly visible.
Right.
And it's also chamfered on the top. Highly visible, not glossy anymore because we've machined it.
Mm.
So what we do is sand the edge of the entire perimeter of the pickup surround. And then polish it. And it's a huge pain. Big time sink.
How do you polish it? Like mechanically on a buffer? Or?
Yes. And sand it, you know, by rubbing it against a granite surface plate that's got a piece of wet, dry sandpaper on
right.
it. So my thought is, well, we're machining the surface. Let's lean into a machined surface finish. It doesn't have to be glossy. It just has to be nice. And the finish we get right now is a tiny bit chattery. You see that it's a machined surface.
Right. That might change once you go to the Haas.
We could get a perfect finish. The alternative I was thinking was a brushed finish would look nice. It would look intentional.
Mm-hmm.
And if you came in, I was thinking about your brush, how you wanted to finish your knives on the CNC.
Yeah, totally.
And how cool it would be to take a brush that the bristles would have to be 90 degrees to the spindle.
Yes, which you can get.
Right. So I was Googling it today. I didn't find anything in my, you know, initial Google searches.
Why are you Googling it? Just go to McMaster.
I didn't think to do that.
Yeah, McMaster has a whole selection of brushes.
Okay. So that's my theory, or my thought is we could just come in and just brush the perimeter and leave a nice brushed surface finish. It would look really cool.
Yeah, totally. So I have another question for you. Let's say you move that process to the Haas and you get a nice surface finish on the side walls. Have you guys played around with flame polishing or vapor polishing at all?
Not in a long time. It would just be another step, and now we've got like a map gas torch involved and whatever.
Right.
It's not so important.
Put it in the CNC, man. Just get a tool holder for that torch. Put it right in the CNC.
It's got to have. So you've got to have something that sparks it. So
well, you just have a. Well, you drive the end of the torch into a bit of metal to make some sparks, and then you start spinning it. You know. Yeah. Anyway.
Yeah. No, I think ideally we eliminate any additional downstream finishing.
Right.
So. Yeah, best case scenario is the edge finish with the end mill is going to give us a nice enough look, an intentional looking finished edge. But a brushed look would also look really nice.
Right. Honestly, I think once you move it to that process to the Haas, because currently you're doing that on a CNC router with, you know, it's relatively floppy compared to the Haas and the spindle isn't as nice and so on. I think once you move that process to the Haas, if you were to use like, nice plastic tooling, particularly if you kept one tool aside for that finishing off.
Right.
I'd be fairly unsurprised if you managed to get, like, basically a mirror.
A mirror. Okay.
Yeah.
That would be cool. I mean, kind of part of me want is, like, now I like the idea of having, like, a satin or brushed surface finish. I mean, if we could get a mirror, though, why fight it? It'll never be, though. I can't imagine it being as perfect as the cast.
Probably not, surface. But I imagine so it will.
That's why
be
I kind of want this disparity between the two. I don't want, like, a super high polished finish and then, like, a fairly high polished look.
Just, like, machine the top too.
Oh, it's an interesting idea.
Right, like, get it all looking the same. Get a face mill with only one insert in it and, like, an aluminum specific insert, and just use that like a fly cutter and take a pass over the top. You'd get, like, a really, really nice finish, but it would look
with
the
no
same
step
as the
over.
Yeah, just one shot.
Well, you'd still have step over though, wouldn't you?
What do you mean?
Like, you're talking about, it's a 3-inch by 4-inch piece of...
Get a 3-inch face mill. Just get, like, a tool big enough to do it all in one pass. And then if you run one insert in that tool rather than a full complement of inserts, that means every single cut is at exactly the same height.
Oh, I see. Is that why you see step over in...
Like, no, I mean, normally you see step over because, like... The machine's always going to deflect slightly, you know, and the direction of the cutting marks is going to be different between the different passes. Like, there has to be a place where they meet up where the cutting marks are different. You know, if you're using a 1-inch face mill to take, you know, 3 passes across a 3-inch wide surface. But yeah, like, basically the best possible finish you could get in a machine like that is with a fly cutter, right? Mm-hmm. So, yeah, if you run a face mill with one insert, then obviously much lower feed rate. Like, you have to divide the feed rate by the number of inserts. So if it's a 5-insert face mill and you're only running one insert, you know, it's not fast, but you'll get a very nice finish.
Mm-hmm. Okay, interesting.
Something to think about, maybe, as an option.
I'll think about that.
Or you could just, because... The other thing you could do is, because the pickup surround is basically like, it has a surface that goes all the way around the outside, but it's not solid in the middle. It's like a donut, you know, it has a hollow center.
Yes. Yeah.
So you could take an end mill, you know, like a 1/2-inch end mill, and have it do just a surfacing operation around the perimeter. Mm-hmm. So it's always a single pass in any particular area, but you're going around the whole thing.
All right. So here's the only problem is the surface on it already is perfect. So if we're talking about,
yeah, right.
Like, you know, how do we make a perfect mirror finish? It's just like cast acrylic. It's just it's
perfect.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, the flawless. Nice thing about taking a finishing cut like that is when you're using the factory surface on one side, it's generally kind of hard to deburr in the machine because you can't run a chamfer mill around that surface necessarily because, you know, that surface might be very slightly higher on one side than the other,
right,
or might be very slightly off the location you want it in Z. Right?
You don't have, it's not perfectly flat reference surface.
Exactly. Whereas if you machine that surface, you know, to make it a perfectly flat surface relative to the machine, you can come with a chamfer mill and hit all your corners and stuff nicely. You could do like a lot more finishing on the machine, right?
That's an interesting point. Yeah. I mean, we definitely see that. We see the chamfer being, you know, it varies.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Food for thought.
Food for thought.
I definitely want to transfer that over to the Haas though, because
it'd be so nice. Mm-hmm. So quick. Yeah, it sounds like we should talk about what I can help you with on software stuff. Come and do some stuff for you.
You know what's just killing me is our inventory.
Mm.
Like, I need a way to add inventory items, put the purchase price in do a first in, first out, turn lumber into, so like, this is the one thing that's like, you know, so we take a big, like a piece of lumber, out of that comes 2.5 body blanks, but some pieces of lumber are 8 inches wide, some are 10 inches wide. Right. The body blank's always the same size, but you have different waste based on that. So it's like, do I assign the, does every body blank have a different price because they came from a different piece of lumber that had more or less waste? Or am I calling some of that wastage and then just writing it off? In which case, I've got to track the wastage from for every piece of lumber. It's anyways. So inventory, we also, we just have way too many SKUs because of all the custom stuff we do. And yeah, reordering. That's what I really need help with.
So we haven't talked about this on the show before, but I made a little inventory system called Kanban QR, which I believe you guys have been kind of using.
I need your help with it.
Right. So basically you have like little printed reorder tags that go, you know, in your pile of inventory at the pod level. And then each one has a QR code on it that lets you just scan it through your webcam and it takes you straight to the website to reorder that thing. Have you been using that? Have you been finding it helpful?
No, I mean, I haven't. I got a little stumped by it.
Okay. Well, I mean, that's my fault.
Now's the time to talk about it. But I have been meaning to get in touch with you about it because I do have a big need for this.
Okay. Yeah, we should totally talk about it. I mean, the reason you're stumped by it is because you're the very first person other than me to use it. So it totally makes sense that you would have problems with it. Yeah, it's been something I've been meaning to revisit for a long time. I just haven't gotten around to it.
It's a great idea. I really need it.
Thanks, man. I'm glad you like it.
I'm just having a little trouble with tech support. They're pretty shit.
Yeah, well, and also you're not the greatest on the technical side, you know. I think computers hate you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, I control alt delete. Not
Buddy,
doing anything.
For you're me. On a Mac. Come on.
Command shift delete. Yeah.
All right. Well, while Nick's doing that, should we look at some listener questions, mate?
Yeah.
Let's do it. So, West of Nowhere on Instagram says, howdy, could I get Nick's opinion on a planar jointer combination versus two separate machines? I'm a hobbyist hoping to make something of it one day, upgrading from two pretty rough machines to something with a spiral head.
Ah, I've been there. I have experience with this exact scenario.
Look at you being useful for once.
Thanks. okay, so we bought, when we first moved into our shop, a combination jointer planer with a spiral cutter head. And the biggest issue we had with it was its repeatability. So to the way it worked is they use the same cutter head. The jointer is used
the top of the cutter head.
The top,
right?
Of it. Like, yeah. So you're running it against the top of the surface. And then to use the planer, you often have to lift both tables. You tip them 90 degrees.
And then you kind of feed it through up, under.
And then you have access to the planer underneath. When you tip those tables back down and lock them in place, the lock mechanism wouldn't actually return the jointer beds into the exact same place. Right. So we always found that we were, you know, trying to like turn the handle that locked the mechanism a degree or, you know, tighter or looser in order to reduce or eliminate snipe, which is when you pass the board through at the end, you get a little bit of extra bite. It's really important that those two tables are coplanar. So the infeed table sits below the outfeed table a little.
Right.
But they need to be parallel and coplanar. And if one is tipped one way or the other, the results just aren't good and you don't get a nice surface. Or more importantly, what we found is when we were actually joining two boards edge to edge, we were we weren't getting a nice joint. You'd be finding a glue line or a bit of snipe or something. So,
oh, okay. So you're jointing the edge of the board, assuming it'll be flat, and then when you glue it up,
yeah,
the two boards aren't meeting.
And a good joiner will joint something extremely flat. So we traded that in. We bought ourselves an old used jointer and planer, separate machines.
Mm-hmm.
We got a 20-inch wide jointer and
a terrifying planer.
And a terrifying planer. Yeah. We borrowed your chain hoist. We removed the tables. We shimmed it with brass shim stock. We made the infeed and outfeed tables perfectly coplanar just by testing it.
Right.
Until we were getting the results we need. Now, if you run a 15-inch wide by 20-inch long board of mahogany across it, when you go to take it off of the outfeed table, it's stuck to it. It's so flat.
Oh, that's sexy.
Now, it is really annoying to set the blades on a traditional cutter head with just straight blades. Hate it. They stay sharp a really long time. We're not feeding thousands of board feet through this thing.
And you're not feeding knotty wood, and you're not feeding reclaimed wood.
We're giving it nice, nice wood. A spiral cutter head, I do fully endorse.
Mm.
Those are really nice.
But you would endorse separate machines with a spiral cutter head.
If you need the space, it's great. I don't find, we sold our planer. I don't find it particularly to be a super useful. It depends what you're doing, right? We're taking 8-quarter lumber and we're making it maybe 1/100 thou thinner.
Right. 8-quarter really, is 2 inches for those of us that don't speak carpentry.
recently we did get some thicker material and now I was like, oh, planer would be nice. Because
you're using the thickness sander for the most of the secondary stuff.
Yeah, we're really not even using it for the type of wood that we would joint, like a body blank or a neck. We're not really planing or thicknessing any part of that. So just surfacing is important to us.
Hmm.
So I personally, if you, who's asking this question again?
West of Nowhere on Instagram.
West of Nowhere. If you're making guitars, I don't think a planer is as important as a thickness sander, in my opinion.
So a jointer and thickness sander.
I would rather have a thickness. If you're having to remove a lot of material, that's where a planer is handy. Also, if you want to make, so when you're making anything, starting with flat and square is super important when you're doing woodworking. So a planer, a jointer makes one face flat and one edge square.
Right.
So you have two, you have a flat surface and a square edge. If you want another a flat surface, if you want to make the other side flat and parallel and square, you would run it through a planer. But for us, we don't really need to do that. We just have the one flat edge, flat surface. Then it goes on the CNC. The CNC uses that, you know, bottom flat surface as a reference surface.
Yeah.
Gotcha.
That's so, one thing that I think is interesting, but, you know, as a parallel between you guys and me, is that you guys make guitars in a way that's fairly unusual for luthiers. And I also make knives in a way that's fairly unusual for knives.
Right.
Yeah.
So that's a good point. If you're making guitars, maybe you do need a planer. we make them, you know, our own way.
Right.
Even though still before we even had the CNC, I didn't find the planer to be like a desert island tool for me.
Right. Right.
I know a lot of people do think it is. It never was that critical to our production.
Right. So get a jointer, get a thickness sander, and get a CNC router. That's what you're saying.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's what I did.
I'm assuming,
Look how it's working out for me.
If West of Nowhere is listening to our show, he's probably interested in CNC. So, yeah, it makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. So that's my opinion. Spiral cutter head, totally sweet. If you have space, separating those two machines is good, especially if you do find you don't use the planer, then you can sell it. And a thickness sander, I find personally more, cause you could put like 40 grit, 80 grit in that, do some, it would take you a little bit longer, but do some abrasive planing. Mm-hmm. They are kind of expensive and definitely not as robust as a planer. The other thing, so a friend of mine, guitar maker, Joe Yanizello, really amazing guitar maker, super high quality, work. Sorry, I don't know if you can hear that in the background.
It's fine.
Tim is drilling.
We can hear it, but it's okay.
He had an industrial planer. It broke. He needed to get it fixed. In the meantime, he went out and bought himself one of those DeWalt
portable
contractor
planers.
Ones.
Yeah.
He loved it.
Really?
Yeah, he loved it.
Funny.
It's funny that I mean a lot of that stuff is like pretty lightly built,
yeah.
But it's also meant to be beat up. Right. So it can, you know, they're not bad. I mean, I don't think it's going to be giving you machinist tolerances, but he was thrilled with it.
Right. Like machining wood. So I mean, you're fucked right from the start, aren't you?
Yeah. So that might be a good introduction to buy a really nice jointer, get yourself a DeWalt planer, depending on how much width you really need, right. could be an option.
Okay. There you go. Yeah. I mean, at some point I would like to have a wood shop as well. Like if I build a shop
after all
country,
you've said about wood.
Oh, don't get me wrong. I love some wood.
I don't
wood.
Think we'll have you.
I love some wood. You know. Yeah. If I was to build a shop out in the country, I'd really love, you know, machine shop, small 3D printing area, a hot shop for doing like blacksmithing and glasswork, and then a wood shop.
Wow. Maybe a spa area too.
Oh, dude. I would love that.
A bar.
Some of those little fish that like nibble on your feet. Great. Barbecue.
Yeah. No, totally. I mean, I like glass. Did you say glass blowing?
Yeah.
Yeah, that is really cool. That was one of my early fascinations in manufacturing.
Mm.
Totally. I mean, being able to do woodworking is, it gives you a lot of options.
Yeah. So we joke amongst my group of friends that we have an apocalypse crew.
Okay.
You know, so I have a friend that is, she just is starting her residency in med school, you know, so she could like take a bullet out of you or cut off an arm if you just got bit by a zombie, you know.
Uh-huh.
I'm the armorer.
Uh-huh.
My girlfriend's the teacher, you know, so we've got the whole crew, you know, so you've got to have some glass blowing. You've got to have the wood shop.
Sure.
You
know? I want no part in it. I'll be the first to go in an apocalypse.
We'll just let the zombies have you.
Just the hassle of it all.
Yeah, that's fair. I just really like being set up to like make whatever I need to make.
Totally.
You know. Cool. I really one of the things I really want to do is get set up to make steel. I really want to do that.
To make it, yeah, that's wild. I can't believe you're even thinking about that.
Well, it'd just be so cool to be able to take all of my machining scrap, all of those chips. You know, even if I'm not like making the raw steel from like iron I dig out of the ground, I don't want to do that. But like being able to reprocess chips into, because like I literally throw out 60% of the steel that I pay for.
That's a lot of wastage. Yeah. I mean, we're probably, I don't think maybe that high, but yeah, you definitely don't use all that you have.
No. Yeah. And one of the other things I'm going to end up doing with the pressure casting thing, the pressure vessel that I recently built is I haven't been saving all of it, but I've been saving some of the G10 chips. So like the fiberglass epoxy composite that I use, I've been saving the chips from that. And what I'd really like to do is, you know, mix it with some more epoxy and cast it back into more G10. Like it's obviously going to be different. It's going to look different. But
that'd be cool though for cycling.
Yeah, and with the pressure casting setup, I can guarantee no voids or anything. So it'll be like really, really strong.
That would just be a cool thing to do, even if it wasn't like, you know, just as an option.
100%. Well, and I've got some really cool stuff too, right? Where it's like, so I was machining a set of scales today that have a very thin black layer on the top because of this particular G10 that I'm using has a black layer on top and bottom. And then it's clear in the middle. And then it has a glow-in-the-dark liner on it. So I'm going to call that one like mint choc chip. You know, it's green with the black specks, you know, like yeah, yeah. to recycle.
I love that sort of thing. I like that, those random pattern.
Yeah, I think it'd be really cool.
Yeah.
And then I'm going to do one called Unicorn Puke. That's just all the colors mixed together. It's like the ones that I wasn't able to separate the colors from. You nice. Just get it all, you know?
This is like, you know, in painting, like custom cars or guitars, metal flake.
Mm-hmm.
I guess you do lots of stuff, you know, lots of stuff are painted with metal flake, but you do get these metal flakes that are like, oh, here's like all the flake colors we have in one.
Right.
It's just like eye numbing.
My eyes are bleeding. Yeah, I don't know. Some of the metallic flake paint jobs that they do that you see on like speedboats and stuff where it looks the flakes are like, you know, a quarter inch in diameter.
Yeah, they're big. You can get some big flake.
How do they do that? Does that just go through a spray gun, or are they like sprinkling that shit on?
You can put it through a spray gun, like suspend it in lacquer.
I guess it just like really folds big up nozzle. And, right.
They're really thin. But the other way you can do it is basically flock it. Like you can get just a
chuck
gun.
It on while the paint's wet.
You could do that, or there's guns that'll shoot dry flake. It's called dry flaking or something like that. And then I guess you don't have the same limitations with nozzle size.
Cool.
We have not gotten into that. We really want to. Surprisingly, we've never actually been asked, like requested to do a metal flake finish. We've done lots of metallics, but metal flake just is like, it's like a bomb went off in your booth. And you know the shrapnel is the flake, and it just gets everywhere and gets into everything.
It's like glitter.
Yeah, exactly. And every guitar that you shoot after that, unless you do an insanely thorough job cleaning your booth, has a bit of glitter in it. Tim with metallic pulls out all the other guitars. We'll shoot a metallic guitar.
Right. Yeah, because I guess if you have like, you know, with a normal lacquer, if you have a tiny bit of overspray, when it's so thin. Going on as overspray, it's going to be basically translucent. You're not going to see it. But with like a metal flake, if one metal flake gets in the wrong spot, it's very obvious that it's there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that makes sense.
So was that our only question?
There's a couple more, but I think we need to do a bit more background research on them before we get to them. So we'll probably get to those next week.
Cool.
We didn't have any mean comments, although I do have...
I should have probably done background research on my question. I bumbled through that. I hadn't thought about that in ages.
You're fine. I did have some questions for you, actually. I wrote some questions down. Where did I write those down? Oh, yeah. Okay. So why the hell... So I've been watching a couple of your Instagram stories recently where you've got a completed guitar body, you know, paint and everything. On the CNC router, and then you are routing holes for pickups and controls and your F holes.
Yeah.
Why the fuck do you plunge? Every time I see it in one of those videos, you're plunging like a two flute straight single end flute. Mill. A single flute. Okay. Just straight into the body. Like, and every time I see it happen, I'm like, oh, sweet Jesus. Why do you do that? How come you don't do like a helical ramp or something?
Because some of those programs are years old.
Gotcha. And they just work, so you don't care.
They need updating for sure. But yes, essentially, our whole strategy was like, let's just get these things done. We were all learning, you know, like.
Yeah, sure.
Mark hadn't done tons of this.
Right.
He, you know, so we were just like, let's get this. Let's just get these things down and then we'll dial everything in, you know.
And they just worked good enough and you never had to change.
Well, it worked good enough and we needed to move on.
Yeah.
And some of the new tool paths on the Haas you'll be happy with.
Well, the other one I was curious about is
the same thing. He cringes when he watches those videos.
Right. Well, that's good. Right.
Yeah. And I've got a few messages from people before being like, you should do this, you should do that. Like,
whatever, bro. Yeah, I mean, I see the same thing with the F-holes. So you're cutting this, like, you know, fancy flowing shape out of the top of the guitar. But the center of that shape is not being turned to chips. It's being left intact.
Yeah.
And whenever I see something like that, I worry about it getting flicked into the lacquer or like breaking the tool because it gets trapped and starts bouncing around or something.
Yeah.
So honestly, I mean,
yes, we've never had it happen. We've never had an issue. Actually, for the first time, one of those center pieces, they usually just drop straight down.
Right.
And we were like, great. But for the first time, one flung outside of the guitar.
Did it get you in the eyeball? Or?
it didn't, luckily. But no, I mean, that was one of the things that when we were speccing at the Haas, I talked to one of the guys at Fender in California, and he programs the Haas machines they've got.
Right.
And he was like, make sure you turn everything into chips because we had an offcut that got stuck in like somehow in between the table and the frame of the machine. Right. And it jammed up the table.
Oh, wow.
And threw out the alignment.
Oh, wow. That's a big, that's a
and
big
he was shocked. Offcut. It was like an eighth of an inch out or something like that. Wood is strong.
It'll, yeah, yeah.
You know, it's like putting a stick in the spokes.
Right.
Right.
The only time I've had something like that happen, so when I'm machining the handle scales, I have like a pallet that comes off the fixture and then it gets put back down and it's held in place with two pit bull clamps. Mm-hmm. And I've never had a problem with that except for one time. And I may have been hungover and I may not have put that pallet back in the right spot or like attached it properly. Mm-hmm. And I like set the machine running and I went out to lunch and I came back and I found a dent in one of my walls and the pallet was nowhere to be found.
it was in the machine, the
shop next door. Exactly.
On the guy's pillow.
Right. So I found it, I found it in behind the machine, but yeah, it had been pulled up like by the cutting forces on the G10. Yeah. And then the actual pallet itself, the steel pallet had been sucked into the tool. And then the whole thing had gotten chucked out of the machine.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah, I'm glad I wasn't there when it happened. I'm glad I was having lunch.
Yeah, because your machine's not enclosed.
That machine wasn't. Yeah, exactly. But, yeah, it's always safer to turn stuff into chips.
Yes.
Except for your fixtures. Don't try to turn those into chips.
That's definitely a new policy, especially in the Haas. And, yeah, it's funny, though. People will message me every single time we post a video of doing post-finish routes. So we're routing into a completely finished guitar. It's been polished.
Right.
It just is. If you go onto our Instagram, @Frank_Brothers, our last post that we posted today, which is, June 29th today? Mm-hmm. We posted it yesterday, rather. June 30th. We posted it on June 29th. It's a guitar. You can see it. It's completely finished, but it's bare. It has no hardware. No pickup routes, nothing. It looks really cool. A lot of people are like, ooh, I want it like that. Unplayable, no strings. So people every time message me is being like, why are you doing that? You're going to totally ruin the finish.
And you never do.
Won't
you
it chip? It. Won't the finish chip? All this stuff. Or like, won't the wood chips, these like fluffy wood chips that are coming off, scratch the finish?
Right.
So people are very concerned about.
Well, it's just interesting, like, because you guys are doing something so different with that, right? Like, people are like, what the hell is going on? It looks wrong.
I get it. It does look wrong. It is weird. I think people are fascinated and terrified by it. We didn't come up with it. We did, but we adopted it and ran with it.
Right. Well, I think on that note, that's a show. Yeah, it is terrifying watching you guys do that. And then once you're actually finished the guitar, you lean it up against the joint to take photos, which still boggles my mind.
I don't. Tim does. And I did it. I had to take photos for the first time in a while the other day, and I did it. And it wasn't as sketchy as I thought. It looks
you
way
didn't
sketchier.
Scratch it?
No, it didn't scratch it.
That's good. All right, man. I think that's a show.
All right. Good talking to you.
Yeah, you too, man. I'm feeling a lot happier now. Thank you.
Good.
I've got a beer in me. I'm going to go have dinner.
Fantastic job, Aaron.
You too.
Brilliant.
Thanks, buddy.
And the work you do is amazing.
When it works. I've got a whole drawer of scrap that would argue with you.
Only at one? Point,
yeah, it's, well, actually two. I need to do a video on that. At some point, there's just like, someone on Practical Machinist said like, oh, what's your prettiest scrap? And I made a GIF of me just pouring a box of like, it's probably like 100 blades and 100 scales just onto the ground, you know?
I've got a corner with like 8 guitars, scrap guitars in it. So
the corner of shame.
Yep.
All right, buddy.
You got to have them. But yeah, cool. Yep. Well, good chatting.
Yeah, you too, sir. I hope everyone has a good week. I hope you have a good week, Nick. Likewise. Don't add to the corner of shame. And we'll see everyone next week.
All right. Cheers. Bye.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.